You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So, welcome to everyone for the last session of today. We've got a great group of panelists and speakers. We're starting with Pauline Rose, who's the director of the Global Monitoring, of the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report. Pauline is going to do a presentation of around 15 minutes. And after that, we're going to have a group of panelists who will come up onto the stage, and I'll introduce them at that point. We're going to start the discussion with the panelists initially, a discussion between the panelists themselves. And then we're going to throw it open to you guys to ask them the most barbed questions you can dream up between now and then. And if you need any help with barbed questions, there are various people in the team who'll provide them with you. Sorry, I should have started by introducing myself. I'm Kevin Watkins from the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings. So the first speaker, as I mentioned, is Pauline Rose. Pauline is responsible for this, Pauline and the team. A lot of you have probably looked through it. It's really an amazing report, and I think Pauline and the team should be really proud of what they've done. It's not just a mine of information, it's a really riveting read. And I think it tackles what is surely one of the greatest challenges of our age, which is skills and youth unemployment. And, you know, that is a crisis that if we don't resolve, it clearly has huge ramifications economically, socially, and culturally. And I think this report really sets out some of the most critical questions that have to be addressed. I think copies of the report are available. I mean, those of you who are flying and only using hand baggage, I'd recommend you not to take more than one because it's pretty heavy, but well worth the read. So, Pauline, over to you to do the presentation for 15 minutes, and then we'll move on from there. Thanks very much.
So thank you, Kevin. One part of his self-introduction that he missed out was that Kevin was the previous director of the Global Monitoring Report. So it's a great privilege for me to be here on the platform together with Kevin in this role. And I think you'll agree that the GMR has built on very strong foundations thanks to the work of Kevin for the previous reports. And I'd also like to thank Brookings for this opportunity for us to present the report in this important event. I'm going to start by giving a brief overview of some of the challenges that we set out in the report this year. As many of you know, the Education for All Global Monitoring Report monitors progress towards 6 internationally agreed education goals, as well as each year picks a specific theme. And as Kevin mentioned, the theme this year is on skills and work. In terms of the monitoring progress towards the 6 goals, we find that progress for the education goals is stagnating. This is across all of the 6 goals. This is a very worrying trend, and I know we've been hearing about it already from the panelists who have been speaking very passionately about education. I'm going to be speaking from my passion of the data and how the data can tell us the story of where we are and what we need to do to actually make faster progress to achieve education goals and what we can do between now and 2015 and how important that is. At the same time as progress towards these goals is stagnating, it's also worrying to see that aid to education is slowing down, that just at a time when we need the commitment of donors to actually accelerate progress, as we were hearing from Gordon Brown earlier, we actually see that the progress towards the financing of education is stagnating, and this is also a worrying trend. The slow progress in recent years towards education goals has left a massive skills deficit amongst young people, and this is the focus of the core part of the report this year. The huge numbers of young people who do not even have the most basic foundation skills they need to find work that pays them enough to earn a decent wage. And amongst those who are in this situation, you're most likely to be living in a poor urban area, in urban slums, in rural poverty, and women in particular are subject to these constraints. I'm going to start by just giving a quick overview of certain aspects of the education goals. I won't be able to go through them all, but I think What I'm going to show is going to highlight the concern that I was raising overall of the stagnation towards education for all. When we look at the goal that is perhaps the most well-known, the universal primary education, we can see that out-of-school numbers in the first half of the decade since the goals were set, that progress was reasonably fast, that we reduced the out-of-school numbers from 108 million to 74 million by 2004. However, worryingly, since then, the trend has really declined. It has got much slower, and of particular concern is that between 2008 and 2010, there has been no progress, that we are left with 61 million children out of school, and that hasn't changed over these recent years. So if we continue as business as usual, we're not going to, by any means, achieve the goals. So we really need to accelerate progress, and this means actually really targeting those that are hardest to reach and putting far more effort to reaching those who are living in these remote areas, the children who with disabilities, those that are child labourers, and so on. So we really need to find new ways and quickly to reach these young people and children. Now, one thing that we've been doing in the report over the past few years is really trying to highlight the extent to which inequality is holding back progress. And in the 2010 report, we put together a database that was looking at education marginalisation. And we've recently produced an interactive website that allows you to click on different countries and different indicators that really highlight quite visually the extent to which education inequalities are at the root of what is holding back progress. So if we look here in Pakistan, we can see that if you're living in the Punjab, you're doing better off than if you're living in Balochistan. But actually, if you're a poor girl living in the Punjab, you're not doing that much better than a poor girl living in Balochistan. So actually, the issues of poverty and your gender are interacting and overlapping with these other issues of where you're living, which are really holding back your opportunities. And these are the sorts of issues that we need to tackle. In the report, we try to address the not only the extent to which access is a concern, but also the interaction between access and learning. We estimate in the report that there are around 250 million primary school children who are failing to learn the basics. Now, some of these are failing to learn the basics because they're not even making it to grade four and therefore are very unlikely to have the opportunity to be able to read and write effectively. Others are not achieving the basics because even if they are in school, they do not have the support in those schools to be learning effectively. So we look across a number of different countries, and just to give a quick overview here on this graph, we can see that the dark purple at the bottom are those that have actually reached grade four and do achieve the minimum level of learning. So the parts that are in the medium purple are those that survive to grade four but do not achieve the minimum level of learning. So they are, you can see in some, like Malawi here at the end, that a very few numbers of proportion of children who are in school in grade four are actually making it to the minimum level of learning. So there is a huge part of the bar that is in that medium colour purple, that they're in school but they're not learning. And then the top part, which is telling us that there are some that aren't even making it to that level. So looking across all of these countries, this is where we come to this estimate that 250 million primary school children are failing to learn the basics. So this is a real learning crisis, which again we've been hearing about, and why it is vital that we put a greater attention onto this, both as we're trying to accelerate progress to 2015 and in terms of what we want to look at beyond then. So it's not just about needing to make sure that children in school are learning, but it's also about what commitments we are getting to make sure that we can achieve these goals. The international community set themselves an objective that no country would be left behind due to lack of resources. Unfortunately, this didn't have a clear target associated with it, so that might be something we want to also think about in the future. But what we see is that what has happened in recent years, there has been an increase in aid to education, but this has stagnated. And we actually, so between 2009 and 2010, the amount of aid to education has remained the same, and that is the same for basic education, which is the bottom part of this bar here. And when we look forward, we also anticipate that this is not going to change, that we're unlikely to see an increase in aid to education based on OECD projections, but also based on what we're seeing in countries like the Netherlands and Spain and so on, who are cutting back aid and the impact that this is going to have on education. So the fact that we already see that the goals are stagnating, that this is going to be compounded by the effect of the commitments that we see through the financing. Now, we could say, well, part of the problem is that there's just not enough money. So, you know, countries are affected by austerity. It's understandable that they need to prioritise their budgets and that aid is not necessarily going to be the priority in those situations. However, one thing that we have been looking at in the report in recent years, and we've been able to look at a bit more robustly this year, is the extent to which aid actually is spent on education in developing countries. For the first time, OECD has actually been allowing us to categorise the money that is spent on students who are studying in rich countries, the students from developing countries who are studying in rich countries, and the amount of money that takes out of the aid budget. And we can see that around 25% of the amount that donors are spending overall is actually spent on the education in rich countries. So that money is not leaving those countries. Now, there are different extents to which this happens, but we can see here for France and Germany in particular, very large proportions. Around 60% of Germany's education aid budget is actually being spent on students studying in Germany. Now, if we were to reallocate this money, this around $3 million, this would actually make a huge difference to the extent to which we can finance education goals in developing countries and reaching those who are most in need. I'm going to move now to the thematic part of the report, which is on skills and work. Now, as some of you might know, this is associated with a third Education for All goal on skills. It's the goal that has been most neglected over recent years since the goals were set. And one of the reasons why it's been most neglected is because it's been very difficult to define and measure. And there have been a lot of heated debates about what we actually mean by skills. I'm not sure that we've fully resolved that debate, but clearly it is really vital that we do address this goal. It's really important that we ensure that young people do have the skills that they need for work and that we actually do something urgently about it. So I think it is quite timely that the report focused on this theme this year. In the report, we identify part of the reason for this being so important is actually because we have the largest youth population ever. One in six of the world's population is aged between 15 and 24 years. And in sub-Saharan Africa, 6 in 10 Africans are aged under 25 years. So there are huge numbers of young people. And in Africa in particular, that youth population is going to be continuing to grow rapidly up until 2030 and beyond. So we really need to reap the benefits of this youth population, see them as the opportunity that they really can be, rather than the threat which it seems they're being seen to be in many circumstances at the moment. But unfortunately, it's the case that we're failing many of these young people. 1 in 8 are unemployed, and perhaps of even greater concern is that 1 in 4 are in a job that are paid below the poverty line. So if you don't have the luxury to remain unemployed. You're being forced to go out to work, earning a wage on a daily basis in insecure work, not sure whether you're actually going to be paid the next day. This is really not a desirable situation to be in. Many of these young people who are either unemployed or working below the poverty line have not even achieved the most basic education that we've identified in the report, that 1 in 5 young people have not even completed primary school. So if you have not even completed primary school, you're unlikely to have even the most basic skills you need to find work. When we set about doing the report, we found that the issue of skills was very complicated. And whenever we talked to anyone about what the report was about, and we say it's a report on skills, they often said, well, what exactly do you mean by that? So as we were preparing the report, we found that it was important for us to simplify what we were meaning by skills, which is obviously a very complex issue. We have, for the purposes of the report, simplified it into three different types of skills: foundation skills, the literacy and numeracy skills that every young person needs that you would normally acquire through primary and lower secondary school; then the transferable skills, the communication skills, the self-esteem, self-confidence that young people need in order to actually get a job and perform well in work; and also the technical and vocational skills, the skills that you need for particular occupations. We then identified that there were two routes through which you could acquire these skills. One is the more formal education route, going through primary to lower secondary to upper secondary. And this is maybe the sort of simpler way of getting these skills if you actually have the right quality and relevant education. But many young people are not having that opportunity. There is one in five, the 200 million young people who don't even complete primary school, need a second chance. So we look at in the report at many programs that are offering young people a second chance in education, many of them run by non-governmental organizations, doing great jobs in reaching young people, but this is not on a large enough scale that's needed. For those that are also going through this route, they need not only a second chance in basic literacy and numeracy, but they also need the opportunities to gain the work-based skills. And there are, again, many good examples of work-based training through traditional apprenticeships, through different forms of vocational skills training tied with second chance programs, which have really helped give young people the chance for better opportunities. Why is this important? It's obviously important for the lives of young people. It can help them to ensure that they have a better future for themselves. But it's not only the opportunities that it gives to young people, it's also vital for the prosperity of countries. We compare the situation of Ghana and the Republic of Korea, two very different countries and, of course, very different contexts that are going on. But there are some sort of quite simple comparisons that you can make to just see the extent to which investing in skills within a framework that really helps to ensure that the skills that are being developed are linked with the skills that are needed through the types of development policies that are in place and the macroeconomic policies that are in place, as happened in the Republic of Korea. So the Republic of Korea was in a similar situation to Ghana in 1970. They both had a secondary gross enrollment rate of around 40%. But the Republic of Korea invested in education to a massive degree and linked that with its work training, with its work program and its macroeconomic policy. And its education soared, as did its economic growth. But in contrast, Ghana's education stagnated, as did its economic growth. Now, there's obviously a lot of things going on, but clearly that synergy between the two did make a difference for the Republic of Korea. Moving on, in the report, we look at a number of countries where, looking at the extent to which young people have acquired foundation skills that we define as where they have skills acquired through primary and lower secondary school. That's the purple part of this graph. The green part is those that have better opportunities to have reached upper secondary. We find that in 30 out of 59 countries, more than half of young people lack even the basic foundation skills. So there are huge skills deficit. It's mainly the poorest, whether they're living in urban areas or rural areas, the green dots at the top here, compared with the purple dots at the bottom, which are the urban rich. So if you are living in a rural area or an urban area and you are poor, you are most likely to be lacking foundation skills. In rural areas where the skills deficits are the largest, if you're a female, you are also even more likely to be lacking foundation skills, the red dots at the top, although there are exceptions in some countries where it is the boys who are most disadvantaged. So this shows that there are need to actually develop programs that link with the different experiences of young people. Just to conclude, in the report we identify a large number of programmes that actually are tackling this problem. So I've set out something that is really showing the extent of a huge problem, but there are things that can be done. There are things that can be done through the secondary school system, reducing the barriers, breaking down barriers, providing, making sure that school is relevant to work, schools working together with companies. But also for those outside of the formal system, there are ways of ensuring skills training can reach both the urban poor working in the informal sector as well as the rural poor through these second chance programmes and through bringing together the opportunities of having some work-based training. So I'm not going to go into detail on these programmes now, but I just wanted to finish by giving one example that we looked at in the report, because a lot of what I've been talking about and a lot of what we hear is about people in poor countries. But actually, we should remember that some of these challenges are here on our doorstep. So in the report, we look at a program in New York City that's run by Mayor Bloomberg that is helping young men in particular who have come from disadvantaged backgrounds to actually have the opportunity to acquire skills. In New York City, you might be surprised to hear that there are around 1 in 5 young people are out of work. And many of these young people who are out of work have not received a secondary school diploma. So Mayor Bloomberg's programme is an example of providing young people with a second chance in gaining skills and getting skills for work. And we're going to be hearing more about that from one of our panellists shortly. Thank you.
Thanks, Pauline. Before I invite the panel up, I've got one question that I want to ask. You can take a seat.
Thank you. For sure.
Not that it's a particularly shocking type of question. Okay, I should say, first of all, that I can't help... One thing I have to note is that the quality of the graphics in the GMR and the presentation have improved dramatically since I left. Which there's obviously no causal connection going on there, but even so, it's an observation. The question I want to ask you, in a way, is the most obvious one of all. If you look at your first two recommendations that come out of the presentation, which was brilliant, the first one is that we need second chance education opportunities for around 200 million children in the poorest countries or low-income and middle-income countries, that we need to move towards free secondary education in those countries. That clearly has huge financial ramifications. I mean, just on the secondary education side, you estimated at another $8 billion. We already have a $13 billion financing gap in primary education. 8 budgets are being cut. Growth is slowing down. If you were an education minister and you were presented with an ambitious scenario like that, the first question I guess you would ask is, where does the financing for this come from? And I just wondered if there's a short answer to that.
I think I might have to go back up there.
Please.
It's a very good question, but I think Gene Sperling gave us the answer just now because he was committing to increasing the US budget for education, wasn't he? So that's the first step. But I think that it is a real challenge, but I think that there is a lot more money out there, and it's not enough of an excuse to say that austerity is going to hold back progress, that we have committed to these young people the opportunity for education. There's money that is currently being used in rich countries that should be being used in the poor countries for developing skills for those most in need. So that's one set of finance. Also the private sector. The private sector are the greatest beneficiaries of a skilled workforce, and yet they are not doing enough as yet to support the education of young people. We estimate in the report that the amount that the private sector is spending on education in terms of education for all goals in poor countries is only around 5% of what aid donors do. So we know that private sector is getting far more active in education, and this is really great, but I think we also need not only the support in terms of the knowledge and experience, but also the support in terms of finance. So there's some suggestions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You should go into politics. That was a very good answer to a tough question. So can I invite our other panellists up onto the platform? So let me start by introducing the panelists. On my right, on the extreme right, is Tyler Littlejohn. And Tyler is from the Bronx, and I think it's his first time in Washington, D.C., so welcome to D.C. and to Brookings. Tyler is both from the Bronx and is working to promote education among young people in the Bronx, in particular young people who are out of school and out of work. He's an assistant trainer at the Mosholu Montefiore Center and a fellow in the Bloomberg program, actually, that Pauline mentioned, and a beneficiary of the program, somebody who's been through the program. So we're really excited, Tyrone, to hear your story in a little while. Pauline I've already introduced, so I'm not going to do it again. On the left of Pauline, we have Claire Ignatovsky, and Claire is Senior Advisor for Workforce Development and Youth in USAID's Bureau for Economic Growth. So presumably you have the secret for economic growth, which we look forward to hearing all about. But Claire is also the principal author of the USAID Strategy on Youth Development and manages the EQUIP program, which is implementing projects in 26 countries. Claire actually also worked as a youth farmer trainer in Cameroon in a previous life, which is very relevant to this discussion, I think. Mary Chandler, to the left of Claire, is Corporate Social Responsibility Director for Global Strategic Investment and Policy. That's a very long job title. At Cummins. Mary is leading Cummins' technical education initiative, and before that had a distinguished career as a lawyer and in public service in Indiana in a variety of public policy positions. So you're very welcome, Mary. And finally, Joseph Munyambanza is from the Democratic Republic of Congo initially and fled the DRC, I think at the age of six, as a refugee, and had his primary education in a refugee camp in Uganda, and then went on to secondary school and ultimately to the African Leaders Program in South Africa. But of Joseph's many achievements, one of them is that he founded an organization to educate other refugee children from the Great Lakes region, from Uganda, Burundi, DRC, and Sudan, I think, and started the Skills for Life program, which is a skills training program for women who are victims of violence. So all of you are very welcome. This part of the program, which I'm just going to invite each of you to make short introductory remarks, which are prompt by asking you a question. If you don't answer my question and answer another one, you're quite welcome. Before you stick more or less with the question. But Joseph, what I'd like to ask you, in a way, is the most obvious question of all, as I asked for Pauline, that you know, you've lived through a very difficult time in your country. You've interacted with a lot of children like yourself who were denied opportunities to develop the sort of skills that Pauline was talking about in the report. And I just wonder if you could give us something of the flavour of what it means to be a child growing up in that type of environment, denied the opportunities to develop the skills that you need to make a better life.
Thank you again, Joseph. And I was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And when I was 6 years old, in 1996-1997, it's when we had these conflicts. And by then, I was already in primary school. I was in primary two, and like any other child in the country, I had dreams of becoming someone, seeing other people in the community developing. I also thought at some point in time I'll be someone big. But here comes the war. My parents, my community, we are all disorganized, so we are pushed into the refugee camp. And in the refugee camp for about 7 years without not getting the peace, because I come from the eastern part of the country in Goma, where even now we still have many problems. Whenever we are trying to go back, another problem comes. And so I got education first from the primary school in the refugee camp. We are talking of hundreds. I think for me going to the primary school, sometimes I could sit under the tree or on the floor with other more than 100, sometimes like 200 children in one classroom. And going through this, of course, every year you see you start school when you are like 300 kids in the class, and then at the end of 1 year you find like more than 60% of children have dropped out of school. But by thriving and seeing what is happening, my parents not being able to continue to support me, seeing how like my dreams which I had before, it's like being blocked as if there is nothing to go ahead, and also seeing how other children, like life is getting going in the wrong direction for everyone. I started thinking that I should focus on education and see if even in this seem to be closed situation, is there anything like a window where I can work hard to get better. And after 7 years of primary school in the refugee camp, I was able to get first grade, like out of 1,000 of kids, and then I got the chance to get a scholarship and go to a boarding school in Uganda. But still, like in the boarding school, I realized that I'm one of, because the refugee camp was 23,000 people, majority were from the Democratic Republic of Congo, but even these other countries, neighboring countries, were all in the refugee camp. So I'm one of very few, like less than 1% of the kids in the refugee camp who has got that opportunity to go to school. It's not that because I'm better than them. Each kid has the ability, each kid has a potential to be like me and to be like you. But then these opportunities which are not given to them make them like suffer, become the worst in a worst situation. And so I wanted to go back to the refugee camp, use this small education I'm getting in the high school to see what I can do. So what I started in 2005 is with the other two friends of mine, two of them being Congolese and one being from Sudan. We started this organization, and I was heading a tutoring program so that kids who are in a primary school, I can help them perform well, motivate them, inspire them to persist in this condition so that maybe at some point you can finish at least primary school, and if all goes well, you can go ahead. And when they started to finish passing very well, I felt motivated. I'm contributing to the community, but also I felt I'm not progressing alone. And in 2006, I had like 12 kids who performed very well, and we got the chance to put them in secondary school. So the following year, I had a bigger number of kids who were like continuing to come. And as we are doing the tutoring program, we are also like going to work for people, because, for example, I had a scholarship. I did not need like money to live on. I had my school fees paid, so we could go and work for someone, work for you. You give us money, we use that money to buy one textbook, and then I use this textbook to help other children in that way. And in 2007, we had 52 children who performed very well in the primary school. But then when we finished that one, we realized that this was the highest number of kids finishing the primary school. And there was only one high school in the refugee camp, and this high school only stops in grade 10. And that does not, like, it's not good for you that you have finished high school. At the same time, it's overcrowded and the teachers are not qualified, because teachers in the refugee camp, if other schools in the public sectors are suffering, you know what is happening in the refugee camp is even worse. And the big problem is that you put especially girls there, they don't stay there for 1 year. There are many problems, pregnancy and other problems. So what with my friends we did, we went to the communities in the town, like in the western part of Uganda, understood what is the opportunities for us to take these students either at the lower cost or for free, but then be able to provide accommodation for them. So what we did, we rented first one house, and then we started with 16 students. We put them. We went to the public schools, explained our situation so they could allow our students to attend high school there, and then our students could come in these rented houses. So we started like that. In 2010, we had around 15 students, of which five were girls, the first girls ever to complete high school in that refugee camp for many years. And then this continued. In 2009, we had started an orphanage, which we also became a very successful thing for us, and we turned it to be a primary school. And in 2011, we have built a primary school for the mostly for orphans, because also sending kids to like teachers who are not motivated, who are not inspired, it becomes a big problem. Sometimes it can even demotivate children. And then our primary school is to cater mostly for the most vulnerable children to see how they can be helped. And then because in Uganda it is only English-based curriculum, yet we are all, most of us are from French-speaking countries. At our primary school, we have like teacher who are speaking French. I don't speak French, but then some of my kids are able to speak French. And then even these ones who are in high school, we are trying to see how they can get to secondary school. So that's my situation.
Thank you. That's It's an amazing story and an inspiring story, and we'll have an opportunity to hear more about it as we go on. Tyrone, the environment in New York is obviously very different than in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. But as Pauline mentioned, there are huge problems of young people being unemployed in New York, as there are in other parts of the United States. And I think, you know, I'd be really interested to hear your experience of, you know, what the program that you're now a member of, but initially came through as a student, what that did for your life in New York, in the Bronx.
Well, I was born and raised in the Bronx, and like normal teenager, I ran into trouble and trying to be popular and stuff in school. Excuse me. And I ran into trouble with the law. I ended up being incarcerated for 3 years. When I came home, I was really stuck under the idea that there wasn't no opportunity out there because I messed up. But I was introduced into the young adult internship program where they opened up all doors for me. Nothing but opportunities. It was almost like building a robot. They took me. They helped me expand my mind. They gave me the clothing. They helped me with communication skills, networking, researching, meeting different people. They challenged me to challenge myself to new things. And through the progress of all that, I learned that I actually liked it. I actually liked working with people. I liked it getting up in the morning. It was actually something new for me, and it was something that I continue to do because I like it now. I really do.
Thanks. Well, Tyrone, whoever taught you communication skills did an amazing job. And actually, I'm not sure if Rebecca's still in the room, but if we could find out who taught those skills and get them to come and talk to us here in Brooklyn, that would be great. Actually, the serious thing, the reason that I wanted Tyrone and Joseph to introduce this part of the discussion is, you know, I think often we talk about education in a very abstract way, and the numbers that, you know, we heard from Pauline are incredibly compelling numbers. But when you hear those stories, I mean, Joseph is now studying biochemistry. Yes. And you think, and I know Tyrone's hoping to go to community college later this year or next year. And you think of the talent that is wasted by failures of skills development, and you see these amazing people. You know, to my mind, it really brings alive just how important these issues are. So thanks to both of you for sharing that with us. Claire, you've been in the invidious position of having to develop a whole strategy on this for USAID. And it would be really interesting for us to hear about, you know, the sort of the skeleton outline of what that strategy is trying to do as you take it forward.
Sure. Tyrone and Joseph, you've just made my job a lot easier. Basically, what we want to do is be able to support people like you, young women and young men, in developing countries to be able to unlock their potential and to be able to contribute to society, their families. And so figuring out how to do that within USAID environment, where we're producing a lot of policies, we have not had a policy on youth. So about 6 weeks ago, after probably at least 10 or more years of advocacy and maybe 18 months of study and preparation, we launched the first ever USAID youth and development policy. And then in addition to that, that's designed to, that's a multi-sectoral policy affecting all dimensions of USAID's work and economic growth and conflict mitigation and democracy and governance, as well as education. We also have our existing USAID education strategy, which has three goals, and we've heard a lot about, there's been a lot of discussion about primary level reading and also education in conflict environment. But we also have a goal two, it's called goal two, which is on workforce development and skills development. So the report that has been produced is music to our ears. So what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about why we created the youth policy, just briefly, and then some of the principles that resonate with the findings and the recommendations of the report. You know, as you said, the demographic argument for why we need to focus on youth is really overwhelming. You really can't miss it. And then in terms of sort of the issue and problem of lack of stability and youth-led movements that are really rising out of decades of discontent in the quality of education and in employment, for example, in the Arab Spring, made us realize not only that we need to work in a concentrated and urgent way with youth and youth skills development at this time, but we also need to be making the investment so that we help countries capitalize on the demographic dividend. That's really an investment that's going to have a return for the next 50 years or more. And then looking more specifically at how USAID operates, we had been conducting youth programs for a very long time, but there was really a lack of coherence in those programs. We were having trouble learning from them and applying them to future programs. And we were also having trouble communicating across sectors. So we were touching youth in different dimensions of their lives, but not having a way to have a set of common principles. So the policy sets out a broad aspirational vision and mandate to consider the not only the how our activities impact youth, but also how youth can contribute to the development goals that we have. And then we have a framework for our investment that includes support, protection, prepare and engage youth, so meeting their basic needs, protecting them from exploitation, giving them opportunities to develop skills, and also to engage with them and to enable them to contribute to the work broadly. And I can talk a little bit more about the principles, but this sort of call to action is going to ask USAID missions in all the countries that we work with to consider how youth can contribute to their strategic planning process and in the programs that we have in country. And it really begins to set up a common lexicon, you know, so that we're speaking more of the same language that's based on research and evidence. And so we're talking about youth assets and resilience, as well as taking a lifespan view. And then probably the most important dimension is one that's going to cause a change in the way we do our business, which is how do we engage with youth? We cannot continue to do the same programming and strategy development in the same way. We need to be able to be more open and to listen.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Claire. We'll have a chance to come back to some of the broader points that you want to make. I mean, since I asked Pauline the financing question, it's only fair that I do the same for you. What's the financing envelope for the program?
So for the youth policy, it's a policy, so it's a broad level mandate to educate and to inspire, but it does not include funding. So it's working with the existing funds that we have within sectors, though it brings the funding of other sectors to education in that there's the mandate to focus on youth. I would just say that we have skills development is complicated within USAID because it really is multi-sectoral, and that we have within one way of calculating been investing at least $100 million. If you look at programming that occurs for the purpose of conflict mitigation, is skills development for conflict mitigation, that brings in a whole additional amount.
Thank you. And Mary, the question I wanted to ask you was, you know, one of the things I'm always very struck by when you look at the youth unemployment issue, that on the one side, you do have these stratospheric levels of youth unemployment in Europe, parts of the US, much of the developing world. But at the same time, you often have recruitment problems in companies, you know, skill shortages and difficulties in recruiting appropriate skills. So I'd be really interested to know in the context, you know, of your own work in Cummins, how you're addressing that apparent paradox.
That's why I'm here. Cummins, just by way of background, Cummins is a Fortune 200 company that manufactures engines, okay, all over the world. So we have these huge manufacturing plants, line workers, then we have workers out in the field that need to service the engines. That's our business, basically. Cummins, like many manufacturing firms, is experiencing a critical skills shortage. So we have huge job openings all over the world, and there are 10 million manufacturing jobs around the world open that we cannot fill. And we ran out of levers to pull. I mean, we couldn't really increase wages anymore. Cummins specific training, you know, was no longer working because the people that were showing up to work, you know, to apply for jobs lacked those very basic technical skills. So what we have done is take all of the research and the writing that goes on at the level like we are here, you know, which we don't conduct. We basically use the stuff that's being generated by you people. And we came up with an education program. We learned sort of how you best educate and train youth in basic technical skills. And we came up with a program which we're calling TECH that we are implementing in 9 sites around the world. And what we are doing is it's a community education program designed to teach employable skills. And those skills include basic mechanical skills, basic electrical skills, sometimes basic computer skills. And when we have to, in certain markets, go back to those literacy and numeracy skills. So what we're doing is, in for example, in Morocco, Nigeria, we go into a community, we find a vocational school, a post-secondary vocational school, we partner with it, and then we seek to sort of augment the curriculum, the teacher training, guidance counseling, their equipment through grant funding through the Cummins Foundation to try to produce better education outcomes. In most of our sites, we also focus on access issues, girls' access to education. In China, we focus on migrant access. And we're testing a variety of approaches in these markets with the hope that we can both improve education outcomes, produce a greater pool of skilled workers for any employer in those markets to hire.
Thank you. I've got one follow-up question I want to ask just to get the ball rolling for you guys to debate between yourself. And I'd like to pitch it to Tyrone, actually, that you, when we were talking before, Tyrone, you were explaining to me that one of the reasons for the success of the Bloomberg program is that it combines skills training on the one side with real work opportunities on the other side.
Yes.
And it's trying to link the two up. Could you just explain how that happens in practice?
All right. What we do is we try to get the best experience for the young adults. So what we do is we ask them what is it they're interested in, what is it they like to accomplish, their goals. And you get all types of answers, medical, they want to be lawyers, they want to work in the hospitals, the courthouses. So what we do is we travel around New York City and we, like she's, almost like what she said, partner up with them. Like we have courthouses, we have hospitals, we have nursing homes, recreation centers, car dealerships. We try to get a little bit of every field. So when we get a student that has that goal that they want to reach, we can send them out there to get that education and that experience. So when you build their resume and cover letter and you send them out there in the workforce to get a job, they not only have the knowledge but some experience in that field as well.
I mean, Pauline, what, you know, in the report, you have some positive examples of that type of practice, but there are an awful lot of negative ones as well, you know, programs which are very high cost, you know, huge upfront investments that don't generate the sort of outcomes. I mean, just standing back from the different models that you look at, what do you think are the most applicable in terms of tackling, you know, the skills crisis and the unemployment problem?
I think one thing, because we're focused on the most disadvantaged, I think one thing that actually has synergies with some of the issues that have been raised is that if you are going to provide young people with the work opportunities, they need not only the technical skills, but also those basic literacy skills. You need to provide them the foundation skills. We identified various programs that were trying to provide young people living in urban poor areas in slums with entrepreneurial skills, because, you know, there aren't any formal jobs available. However much they try in many countries in Africa, for example, they're not going to get a job. So it's about how they can actually set up a business themselves and so on. But many of these programs were taking it for granted that the young person already had basic literacy and numeracy skills, which was not the case for those that needed these opportunities the most. So it's really about making sure that there is the opportunity to bring those different skills together, that it actually reaches those that have need those opportunities.
By the way, do feel free to talk to each other. But if you don't, I'm going to keep asking you questions. So, Joseph, one thing that really springs to mind from the part of the world that you grew up in is that for young people who are denied a chance to get a decent livelihood, you know, an education and the skills that they need to get a decent livelihood, in a society where there are very deep tensions and ongoing conflicts, presumably there are huge risks of children, of marginalized children who have lost hope being drawn into those conflicts. I mean, is that something that you observed a lot or you saw a lot when you were growing up?
Thank you. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we had, because you see, I think in the previous presentation, one gave an example or a quote which showed how, like, lack of hope can be the worst thing you can have in life. And every day, and it's not yet over, we face that problem with our young people, but even with some parents. And the biggest thing we had to deal with is to first build hope for young people and also build trust with the people who were surrounding us. Sometimes the parents of the children we are dealing with, and also with some guardians who are taking care of the orphans, and also to build a child of, to encourage someone that go to primary school, yet you don't have money to support someone in secondary school. So sometimes we want to build someone's like life, want to you to have hope for 20 years, but at some times we just want to first help you have hope for 1 day or 2 days. Have hope, we say, can you have that hope which can help you finish primary school? And because we ourselves don't know what is next after primary school, we just say this is the first stage, our goal. And then after that goal, together we're going to see what happens. And I think times life we don't know where it is taking us. But I believe that even when I don't know where I'm going, but I know something is wrong, I think the good thing you can do is to see how you can continue moving. And like starting this group, it's called Kobarasi, Congo, Burundi, Uganda, Rwanda, and Sudan. We did not know because by the time I started, I was 14 years old. So I didn't know really where I'm going. But I knew that something is wrong and something needs to be changed. And so we continued like that. And by building on that small hope, I think it helped us. As I finished high school, I helped others finishing primary school, and we got now even the motivation from the small hope we had now to continue with the secondary school. And I think at times if you can't do something for 20 years or what, it's good for you to do what you can do today and tomorrow, and then the future may be better for you, but make sure you deal with today very well in the best way possible.
Thanks. That's a really important message, I think. Okay, so you asked for it. You know, one of the things that often strikes me when you read the literature on skills development as written by educationalists is that there's a sort of assumption if you produce the skills, somebody will employ them. And yet, if you look at most of the positive examples that Pauline gives are from countries that have industrial policies that are geared, you know, where government takes some responsibility for deciding, you know, which parts of the economy are going to expand, creating incentives for labour-intensive growth. And also, most of the success stories happen to be relatively high-growth economies. What I'd be interested to know, actually both from Claire and Mary, is, you know, what in the case of the USAID strategy, you know, what is the strategy for differentiating between countries that are locked into, you know, relatively low growth, small-scale enterprises, you know, very weak employment generation, and countries which have better prospects for economic growth?
Yeah, we need to take a completely different approach. I mean, there are some dimensions that cut across, such as certain skills, the foundational, transferable, and technical skills. Those cut across all types of countries, I would assert that. However, we've discovered in working in Haiti with the community partnerships approach, for example, that it's a lot more labor intensive. Young people need more support to develop the skills that they often missed if they had to drop out of school or didn't have the opportunity to go to school, in terms of their being able to find that hope to connect to their purpose in life if they've been stigmatized, and then to incrementally be able to usually create their own work from often family livelihoods or through cooperatives or work with their fellow youth in businesses. So that process takes more time. It takes more resources, and it's been difficult to reach scale for those kinds of programs. We know the different components, but to be able to get them all together and to get that funding to reach youth at scale has been hard. And then for the countries that are more at a middle income level, there's programs that have been very successful with a modest amount of life skills training and then assistance in getting a job. That's been easier. So just the recognition that we are working with very different countries with very different economies.
Thanks. And Mary, this is the last question before I throw you to the tender mercies of the audience. You know, one thing I'd be interested to hear from you in your experience of working, especially in low-income countries, is about the partnerships with government, because before you were describing, you know, what seems a very successful program, but that's like a program, as I understand it, which is a sort of company scheme or company project. But I guess to deliver on the sort of scale that we're talking about here, that ultimately you as a company need government to kick in as well, and you need some sort of partnership with government to facilitate that. And I just wondered if there are examples of that you could share.
I thought I'd go back quickly to the last question, because I have this fear that I'm going to get kicked out of the post-primary education network, because we generally don't go into low-growth countries. And sometimes I'm on the phone and I think, you know, when you talk about sub-Saharan Africa and you talk about these really constrained environments, and companies like Cummins generally go into countries that have high growth potential. That's why we're business. So I'm really grateful that I haven't gotten kicked out yet. But that said, you know, we do, even in high growth countries, we try to work within the economy with those people who do have access to education problems, and try to, we invest in education all over the world, not just this program. But it's important to remember that this is not a company program. This is a community-based program. So that when we are forming these education programs at these schools, we are looking not only for government partnerships, but other investors in the programs that have the same issues that we have. So that that we are looking for other, like, you know, other companies looking for technically skilled workers. We are just on the very early stages of talking to governments about workforce development issues and other private partners to come into our schools and invest with us. So I hope that by this time next year or the following year, we'll have more information about government partnerships with our programs.
Okay, we'll be sure to invite you back next year.
I look forward to it.
So what I'm going to do now is throw the floor open. I think what we'll do is we'll take questions in batches of three, and you can either direct them to individual panelists or to the panel as a whole. So we'll start over here. If you could say who you are as well, please, to start with.
Kathy Stanogle with... I'm Kathy Stanogle with Planet Aid, Humana People to People, and my question is directed towards Cummings. Have you started looking at investing in primary education as, I guess, a way to minimize your costs in doing the vocational schooling? And what would convince you as a company to, what would be the argument that would win you over to invest in primary education?
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Barbara McDonald Moore from the Canadian Teachers Federation, and I'm particularly glad that Joseph and Tyrone were here today to share their stories. We work with teacher organizations to get them to, or encourage them, or enable them to support public education and to bring the quality level that sometimes falls between the cracks from pre-service training where there's no ongoing. But my question now is that in the Caribbean, they have universal secondary education across most of the Caribbean. That means for a lot of, particularly the boys, it's a second chance. It's coming in. Many of them have been out of school. And what we hear from the teachers is that they are not equipped with the differentiated teaching skills and various practical things to try and manage a classroom and deal with this different attitudes and different aptitudes. And in fact, they're drawing on our work with special education, practicums and that, to bring that to bear. And my question is, when you do have a second chance or other areas, how do you then make sure that that the teachers in the system can cope with that?
Thank you very much. You go first. It doesn't matter. But I'll take the other one next.
Okay. Steve Cleese, University of Maryland. One comment this morning was how educators need to go out of their comfort zone sometimes to deal with issues that are not educational directly, but have a lot of implications for whether education is successful or not. And I want to pick up on a point that Kevin raised. I mean, I think this is all important work, and the situation our youth are facing is dire around the world. But the approach taken is generally what economists call a supply-side approach. It's increasing the human capital of our youth and the hopes that that will open up alternatives for them to gain successful employment and other future activities. And, you know, that's debatable. There's an argument that private employment, despite openings in Cummins, is very below what the skill levels existing in our current labor force, and that we have 2+ billion people who are unemployed or underemployed on this planet because we're not creating sufficient employment. And it's not a question of just high growth or low growth countries, it's a question of public policy. And so there are many who would argue that leaving employment creation to the market has been the problem, not the solution, and that we need government interventions in indirect and direct ways to create employment for our youth. And I just wondered if in any of your deliberations about the problem with youth and skills, the employment generation problem was taken up and discussed.
Thank you. I'm going to take two more in this session, then I'm going to ask the panel to respond, and then we'll go for another round.
My name is George Papayannis. I'm with UNESCO. My question to the panel is, I get the sense that, to borrow a phrase from the auto industry, we have aftermarket fixes going on. Tyrone went through the New York City schools, ends up in jail, and not until he gets out of jail does he get into a program that actually helps him realize his potential. The people at Cummins come in afterwards at some point within educational systems to try and teach them skills that can be used in the industry that they're trying to service. In the previous panel, there was a question that was posed by the PhD candidate from Harvard who asked about private-public partnerships. And the question was interpreted within the terms of whether or not funding could come from the private sector. And I'm wondering, where do we inject the private sector into the policy debate, and how do they inform the policy process so that questions about what is being taught in schools matches with what industry is seeing as its needs in the communities? And I'm not sure that we've addressed that yet. I'm looking to see how we connect the dots, and that's what I would pose to the panel.
Thank you. Marcus.
Thank you. My name is Marcus Morell. I'm from the Missoula Montefiore Community Center. My question is to you, Joseph. First, I want to thank you for being here, and I read your bio yesterday, very inspiring. My question to you is, how do we in the U.S. get our young people to actually really focus in on developing more opportunities for themselves versus getting the public and the private sector involved? You said you and your friends started a school, and I'm pretty sure right now it's very successful. What encouraging words you can give to someone such as Tyrone or Youth in America to really go out and challenge themselves and actually fight for their own education and development?
Thank you. Well, we have five questions and five panelists, and because I've spent so much time in education, even I can work out that's one each. So, Joseph, one question was directed explicitly to you. Do you want to start us by responding to that?
This one?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I think my experience, first in the refugee camp, then like in other more a bit developed places like South Africa and going to boarding school and then to the USA, what I've seen is that it's very important when we want to develop someone, to help someone to discover himself. And while it may be an advantage to be a young person in the USA, I think if you are like from low income family, it may be a disadvantage, because my experience is that when you grow up seeing challenges around you and you get someone to touch on you, telling you these challenges, if you deal with them, they can be for a short time, but if you play around them, they can be lifetime problems. And such things helps you to understand, what is my responsibility here? What can I do? Is it accepting the problem or dealing with the problem? And the problem which is here is trying to help people not to focus especially on the media, because we find most young people, instead of trying to understand who they are, the potential they have in themselves, you start seeing like people who are, you can say, other role models, but then you are really a complete different person. And it becomes, you follow something which is not, you are not just passionate about it, but because you are seeing someone is a star, but it's not your passion. And I think if you help people to understand their passion and also the feeling of sense of responsibility, and then if you understand your passion, you get that potential to do something. I think you grow up when you are happy, and at the same time, you bring the good for many people. And I think that's what helps me even like from the refugee camp to grow up. I think it's because I realized that education needs to be addressed. I want to be a doctor when I grow up, but I realized that being a doctor and the people who are not educated may not solve. And education was needed for everyone, for other people like me to be themselves and do something. So I think it will help people to be who they are and to discover themselves and then go for it.
Mary? I just want to, I mean, please feel free if you want to respond more broadly, but I guess the question that Steve Cleese raised about the, you know, are we focusing too much on the supply side of skills and not enough on the demand side?
It's a great question, and I'm here generally talking about our tech program, but you know, we are partners with Save the Children on education in emergencies, so we invest in that. We invest millions of dollars every year in community education, so we invest in primary education too. Okay, we invest in community education coalitions in our plant communities, where we create coalitions of government and trade schools and primary education schools, where we go to governments and we say, look, these are the skills that we need in our workers, and we try to influence curriculum. So we invest all along the education spectrum, all over the world. But for purposes of this today, you have to be very disciplined in your focus, because people are very passionate about education. So when we start a technical education program at a vocational school in Morocco, you know, in a month after we start the program, people are wanting to expand the program into all sorts of different things, all of which are incredibly worthy. But if you don't maintain really critical focus on what you're doing, then money, it's just like throwing money into the air. So the data on primary education is clear, okay? You've got to invest in early education. Everything is very worthwhile, and we do all of it. But when you're trying to really create a result that you can measure, you have to be really, really focused, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you. I guess one of the questions that was raised, Claire, and I think an important one in the context of the USAID strategy, is the role of teachers in all of this. That, you know, in a way, they are the interface between the kids that we're talking about and the opportunities that we're aspiring to. I wonder how teachers fit into the USAID strategy.
Well, I would like to go a little further with this, because there was several questions about this this issue of supply and demand, and if you don't mind, I'll veer off into that a little bit and then try to return to the teacher issue from a youth development point of view. But You know, we do not take within the domain of work that we call workforce development, skills development, we do not take a supply side view. We see this as a dynamic system of supply and demand. From the very beginning, we are talking to the private sector, doing labor market analysis, and we don't take what some have called a train and pray approach, train them and then pray that they get a job. So we have bridging strategies. So there, yes, there is some time of training, intensive training in all the skills that are mentioned. But then there's a whole set of intentional practical learning opportunities, internships, apprenticeships, job shadowing, interfacing with private sector leaders. And so the approach is much more comprehensive. And then the challenge of there simply are not enough jobs, that is our central challenge. And I would say that we need to, what the youth policy does is enable folks in education to talk to economic growth officers who have a completely different set of tools. We have great tools around curriculum and teacher training. They have sets of tools around financial markets, financial products that are specially designed for young people, that focus on savings and move them up through a process to be able to take out a loan and create a business. They have approaches of value chain analysis, which traces how services and goods move from local to global markets and what specific kinds of skills development is needed at these different levels. So that's why I say it is a partnership. And I think also around job creation, there's a couple areas where we need to pay more attention to. One is entrepreneurship. There's not enough evidence around that, and the evidence that there is mixed. And the other is service learning. So youth service has been very important in the United States. It was critical during the Depression, when we had the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and millions of men and women were put to work during hard times, and they developed the skills, and eventually we moved out of that. And I wonder if some of these, I think we've greatly underutilized service work.
Thank you. Pauline, could I ask you to tackle, we had a question on the importance of not understating the relevance of primary education as we look at this. Could you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately if you don't start both with early childhood and primary education, getting all children into school and a good quality education, then everything else is going to fall apart. You're not going to get the technical skills, you're not going to get the entrepreneurial skills. But having said that, we cannot wait a generation. We've already lost this generation of young people, these 200 million young people who have missed out on that opportunity, which is why we were advocating strongly for the need for far more opportunities in second chance programs. And so linking that with the teacher question, I think the thing is that these programs are often, there's some really great programs that we highlight in the report. There's the CAMFED's program, for example, in parts of Africa, providing young women with skills training combined with assets of some kind that helps them to actually put their skills into practice. And, I mean, what we particularly liked about CAMFED from our point of view is not only was it a great program, but they actually evaluate the program and learn from the evidence that comes out of that program and feedback. And I think that's a really important learning strategy. But these programs are run by NGOs. These aren't civil service teachers. They're not sort of part of the whole civil service training system and so on. And they're on a very small scale. So it is a question as to actually shouldn't the governments be doing far more to include these programs within their overall national strategies? Okay, they might not be able to fund it all. They need partners to do that with. But that actually there needs to be more cohesion between these to make sure that there is strengthening and scaling up of the programs.
Thanks. Taryn, the question I wanted to put to you is the one that George raised, which is about it being better to prevent a problem happening than trying to fixing it after the event. And I guess, you know, one of the things that's happening, or that we see happening in the U.S. education system now, not just in New York, but in other areas too, is that I think this is the first post-war generation where education attainment is actually lower for this generation than it was for the previous generation. And an awful lot of kids are, you know, dropping out of school before they've completed secondary education. And I'd be really interested to know, you know, partly from your own experience or your own observation of what you see going on in the Bronx, I mean, what is going wrong in the school system that so many kids are ending up in situations like the one you describe, you know, where you're not able to realize your potential first time round? Mm-hmm. What would need to have been different in your case or more broadly?
Well, out of personal experience, I would say that it would be nice if the teachers, the educators should just have a little bit more patience with the students, because no individual is the same. Every individual is different. Everybody's household is different. Everybody comes from a different background. So you have all these different students coming to school with all these different backgrounds with different problems. Some households, money is more important than education because more people worry about their rent and their lights than they do about their school books. So I say to educate more on job skills and primary education at the same time when they're going to school. So when they come to school, they're learning not just pass this test is next week, but, you know, learn how, what would you be interested in? Not just in high school, but junior high school, elementary school. I know they ask the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? But maybe they should enforce that question more. Maybe get to know the students a little more on a personal level. Be more patient and try to relate to them. And I noticed, out of experience, that young adults, they take a liking to and get more comfortable with those who relate or somehow understand them in a way. And they seem to move faster, move along faster, understand faster when they can get a basic understanding from the individuals trying to educate them. So I would just say basically just to promote these skills in early education and not just towards college or towards high school. I say we promote these skills as such as communicating, networking, resumes, cover letters, researching, and reaching for your goals early in education. So they won't have to wait the second time to think about it. They'll know about it the first time. And maybe education would be more important to them if they knew what their potential was the first time instead of messing up and coming back the second time.
Can I ask you quick, when you were in high school, did your high school have a vocational education type program, like a shop program or any place where you could work on, do manual skills, like work on engines or things like that?
I went to Truman High School, which is located in Co-op City. Only vocational or educational program was ROTC, which is like a...
Really?
That's really... And not many teenagers at that age, like 16 and 15, 17, they're not interested in joining the Army that young.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we found when we started our tech program around the world is that our U.S. employees were sort of outraged that we were investing, you know, in some far-off, you know, continent when they felt like the problem was so acute here in the United States, because a lot of our workers started out working on farm equipment. It's a lot of our rural employees. And they felt like the lack of attention being paid by the U.S. education system to a vocational pathway in high school was the cause of a big problem here in our own country.
Yes, I would actually like to agree with that, because I've noticed, once again, out of personal experience, the students I work with, back to a question I heard in the audience about the marketing, making the jobs, mm-hmm. and not more the students and people making up their own jobs. I've run into a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of potential entrepreneurs who has a lot of great ideas for this country, who wants to be in the medical field, who wants to go across and travel and help other people in other countries, who want to take care of sick babies, who want to, and they have all these different ideas, great ideas, but they don't have the skills or the education or even a personal educator to relate to share and actually have the courage to want to take the steps to actually create that job. Mm-hmm. That's why I was going with patience. With that
Thanks, Tyrone. I actually think Tyrone's making a point that's relevant not just for New York here, but more widely about the importance of focusing on learners, on the kids, and giving kids hope at a really, 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 really early age. We're sort of beginning to run out of time, so I know there are loads of hands that are going to go up now, so I'm going to have to be arbitrary, and I apologize for that. But I'm going to take three questions, and each of the questions is going to take less than 1 minute to ask. So, who wants to? One, two, three.
Hi, Mehna Aziz from Pakistan. 1 minute is very... yeah. So I think what we are hearing from Pakistan is the fact that curriculum has to change because the country is very diverse and, the parents are demanding now that the curriculum has to be very close to what their occupations are, fishery, agriculture, otherwise, because industry is not very robust at this moment in time. Also, I would like to draw attention on something that we have done very quickly on educational entrepreneurship of youth who are graduating and have nothing to do and are very passionate. We are training them to open schools and get out of schools children, back into schools. So entrepreneurship element is also extremely important where you need to show hope and industry is not there to get these kids in.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. My name is Frank Method. I agree with the point that demographics are driving a lot of this policy. I don't understand what people are talking about when they talk about the demographic dividend. There are maybe 50 countries in the world in which you have still rapidly growing young cohorts, and that includes most of the countries that USAID is focused on. That's Sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, not even all of those regions, Tunisia, Mauritius, South Africa, have declining cohorts. But there are 100-plus other countries in which those young cohorts are beginning to be stable, if not actually declining. Look at the declines in the shape of the pyramid in places as large as Indonesia, much of South Asia. In Japan, you soon will have more grandparents than grandchildren. China is beginning to reassess its one child per family. I'd like to hear a little bit more clarity as to what we mean by
okay.
that dividend.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura Ashley, or LA. My question is just about thinking about migration. Youth nowadays with skills, people are migrating, whether you're a refugee or in this country as well. I'm just wondering how we think about that when we address skills.
Thank you. That was a superbly brief question. And in fact, you've actually just won the gold medal for the most succinct question of the day. And you've opened the door to the person sitting just behind you, who, if they are similarly brief...
Thanks, I'll be brief. I'm Nora Files, representing the UN Girls Education Initiative. I heard from Claire a really interesting, quick throwaway line that this is a very complicated area, and I thought, oh, yes, that's very interesting. And, in fact, we haven't unpacked the complication of women within this dialogue, where women's experience of the labor force is very different, and in terms of opportunities for training, as identified by Pauline at the front end of her presentation, is also not the same as boys. The remark was that if you're a girl, a poor girl in a rural area, you're least likely to have access to training and secondary school. So thanks. I would like to invite you to reflect on the political nature of this dialogue around women's experience. If you're talking about youth
Thank
in
you.
A developing country, they're women. Thanks.
Okay, so you don't have too long to reflect, but what I'd like to invite you to do is to maybe take a minute or a minute and a half to, if there are particular points that you wanted to respond to, do, but really to share any closing remarks and thoughts that you have with us. So if we start this time with Tyrone.
There was one point that I want to speak about with minorities in other countries. Very important. But there's a lot of job opportunities out there for them too, because, like, for example, myself, I only speak English. So that would make it hard for me to get a bilingual job. But for other people that come in from other countries and they obtain the same skills that we're training in, it gives it a diverse, almost like a versatile environment where they can help promote what I'm promoting, but I can't just speak the language. Am I making any sense when I say that?
It makes a lot of sense to me, Pauline.
Yeah, so I guess just in concluding, following from Nora's comments, and just to advertise that in partnership with UNGAI, we have produced a gender summary of the report, which does actually sort of go into detail in some of the gender issues about how women are often invisible in the labour force, that we don't actually know the reasons why they are invisible. Is it through choice? Is it because they actually are doing a lot of work that's unpaid or is very low paid? The evidence does show from what we have in the report that they are most likely to be working below the poverty line, regardless of their level of education, so which suggests that it's not that they're not working, but actually that for the most disadvantaged young women, they are facing discrimination not only in education but also in the labour force. I just wanted to conclude by, I think, for this report, we've actually really benefited from hearing the voices of young people, and I think you'll agree with me that that's probably the most stimulating part of this panel discussion today as well. And just reflecting back to one of the young people that we had on the panel when at the launch in Kenya, there was a young man who similarly had come from a really challenging background who, like Tyrone, was now actually motivating other young people. And one of the things he said was, look, you know, if you give young people skills, if you give them the support that they need and you give them an egg, they can become a poultry farmer.
Thank you.
So I guess since I had brought up the demographic dividend, I should probably address that just very briefly. It is true that there is a general trend towards aging, and we are moving in that direction. However, a lot of the countries where we're most concerned because of the results of that we're seeing in terms of education and lack of access in sub-Saharan Africa and in countries, in particular countries in South Asia, the youth population will be growing for another 20, 30 years. And so there's really two kinds of structures that we're concerned about. One is where there is a large bulge now, there is a need for urgent attention to unemployed young people. And then there's the need in the other kinds of countries where the population is growing over the next few decades, that the investments need to occur now so that the demographic dividend can be realized two decades from now. So it is a longer-term process. And so this is a whole area that we need to grapple with in terms of different approaches around the age structure cohort.
Thank you. Mary?
I guess the last thing that I would like to say is a concern that was raised in Pauline's report, which is one of the concerns about private investment in education is transparency. We are operating very transparently, and everything that we have, our white paper, I share with everyone, including direct competitors. We learn from all of you and from this group, and the issue of migration is one that we have not figured out. It's a really important thing to our initiative, but we need to learn from you. We will then share our learnings back. It's a feedback loop. We are on the ground doing this, and there are people doing research on this, and we really hope that it's a very, very active loop of learning and sharing.
Thank you. Joseph.
Thank you. I think I would have 2 points to finish up with. One of them would be about the situation or to make learning better, because like I'm saying, for about 15 years, where I come from, the eastern part of the country has been having problems, and as you know, we have lost more than 6 million people because of wars. And as the minister said, that about 7 million children are not in school, and if you are talking of the nation, if you are talking of the generation, you can understand where the situation is going. And I don't know how the Millennium Goal is going to address these problems, and these children are like people who can be like me, who can be like you. These are the people who bring the country to the best level we want to be. And as we are talking for migration, I've been for a refugee for a long time. It's not that I wanted to do that. And there are people who choose to migrate, but there are others who are being forced. And while we are here, we hear these stories, I think our voice sometimes, we need to participate in how we can help talk for these people so that they can also have peace, their land, they contribute to the world. Another thing I would talk about is making education more sustainable. I think while we are getting quantity of education, it's not avoidable. Quality is very important. Skills are very needed. But then there's another thing you should understand, that at some point, if we have many people who have skills who are prepared for a job, there's a time we're going to have like that bottleneck where there are not enough jobs. And I think we need to invest in the curriculums mostly to see how curriculum can inspire people to be more creative, how they can create jobs. And this will help us have like more sustainable and long-term development. And if we don't do it, I think at some point people in the future, they may start like being frustrated with education again. And I think it's very good for us to invest in that long-term situation.
Thank you, Joseph, very much. Just two really brief observations from me. One is, you know, I'm often really struck when I visit developing countries in Africa and South Asia, when you go to villages or urban slums, or you talk to kids who are child labourers, that they have this primordial drive to get an education. And it's an extraordinary thing, actually. You know, you look at the odds against them, and you know, you talk to them about their ambition, and they all want to be a doctor or engineer or a dentist or a pilot. And actually, when you listen to people like Joseph and Tyrone, you realise that if they had a chance, they probably would be. And the vastness of the waste that happens because of the sort of problems that Pauline outlined in the report right at the beginning, I think really has a human face, and it's easy to lose sight of that. So thanks to all of you for bringing our attention back to that. And the second observation is, you know, you can't help feeling, and I think this came across from all of the presentations, that we do live in extraordinary and very dangerous times. That when you have youth unemployment rates of 60% in Spain, you know, when you have whole regions of the world in which, as Joseph said, you know, kids are losing hope because they haven't had a chance to develop the skills they need to build a better life for themselves, you know, that has consequences that go beyond the education system. It has consequences for the social fabric of society, for political stability, for conflict, and many other areas. And I think as a research community in education, we really need to put this right at the centre of our agenda. The last point I want to make is this. I know I've often said in the past that, you know, that I contrast the excitement that you feel when you work on education in a developing country with the boredom that you feel in many of the international conferences that we all pitch up to talk about the Millennium Development Goals. And, you know, there are many controversial issues that were touched on today, but I think no one would say that discussion was boring. It was an amazing discussion, and I really want to thank all of you for doing so much to, you know, to lighten up the afternoon and to give us so many insights. So thank you very much. Tyrone, you want to
say have a last couple of words before we start, please?
This guy really... Did you teach him communication? We're going to hire you straight after this. So, Tyrone, keep it brief, though, yeah?
Yes, very brief. In closing, I just want to thank everybody for having me here, and please advertise and promote these programs that you hear about, because nowadays I want everybody to realize that the kids, the young adults that we're speaking about, is our future. These are our doctors, our lawyers, our police officers, our firemen. And they need to have the skills that they got to have the right skills to keep this world in order. So please, and walking testimony, change is here.
Okay.